Now, you're familiar with the intelligent design versus evolution argument that's been raging. My 75-year-old atheist nemesis has put his hat in the ring here a couple of weeks ago and talked about the subject. And one of these days, I'll probably write something on that too. And I have a notion at the end of the article saying, "Okay, bring it on, Bob," because I know he'll write to me after I write the article. But that's an ongoing phenomenon. And the most ludicrous recent example of this trend, I don't know how many of you saw this, I might have mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, was a claim that was in the Ben newspaper that purported to explain that the way Jesus walked on water was that he walked on chunks of ice. Yeah, and this is an unusually bad winter, and there were chunks of ice, that's how he walked on the water. Which I guess means that probably the real miracle was not him walking on water, but the real miracle was that both the disciples were in and didn't sink. Right? Because being hit by chunks, because the Bible account says a very strong wind. Well, what's... Only one more. One more. Gospel of Judas. We can't forget that. Okay? I'd like to read you a brief quote from the Christianity Today, which tries to put some common sense on this whole situation and why it's happening. This is posted on April 13th, 2006. And by the way, you can get a free online newsletter from Christianity Today. I found a lot of good material there. In fact, I used to subscribe to the magazine, and when I found out about this, I thought, well, hey, why subscribe to the magazine? The best articles are online. And copy and paste and everything. Anyway, the title of this is The Jesus and Judas Papers, a look at recent claims about Jesus. That's another whole trend right now, is the quest of what they call the historical Jesus. All kinds of flaky ideas. Keeping up with the new Jesus books these days takes a scorecard. Just about the time one thing is behind us, a new one pops up on the radar. There is no doubt that the Da Vinci Code movie has spawned an array of works trying to take Dan Brown to the next level. Not all these efforts possess the same significance, but they are all trying to hype a revised understanding of Christian history. We may well be entering an era of more discussion about early Christian history than has existed in decades. I hate to tell you that, but such hype needs to be shown for what it really is. More efforts to discredit Jesus, the apostles, and the Bible, and to exchange these central elements of the Christian faith for a less unique, domesticated form of Christianity. The latest cycle of hype began with the Jesus Papers. This work by one of the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, represents a continued effort to find the roots of Jesus' work outside of Israel and Judaism, the very opposite of what our class taught and what I've been covering in the Bible study. In scenes that are only loosely connected, the author posits that Jesus spent time in Egypt at a secondary and deviant temple in Egypt. He also is far too quick to associate Jesus with Mithras and Osiris myths. There is absolutely no evidence for Jesus making such a trip to Egypt during his adult life or late childhood. The author also claims that there are papers that argue Jesus survived the crucifixion and went to Egypt as late as AD 45. The second work was the gutsy release of the Gospel of Judas. This is a much more serious find. It's a legitimate work of the second century, preserved in a fourth century manuscript. Well, it goes on to talk more about that, but really all you need to know about the Gospel of Judas is it was written by Gnostics, okay? And it represents Gnostic doctrine that bears virtually no resemblance to the New Testament, but it's legitimate. You know, it's one document. I forget how many, Wayne, you know how many thousands of documents there are of the New Testament? It's like 5,000 or something? 52,000. So the odds are 52 to 1 if you look at it mathematically. But, you know, people today are thinking, wow, look at this, look what we just found. So one document, and some people are ready to throw out the 52,000 documents of the New Testament. Well, anyway, that's kind of the trend that's taking place. I didn't even bring it. I was going to quote it, and I thought, well, boy, I'd never get into the message if I quote too much. But the World Magazine, most recent issue, I think it was talking about a professor that was fired at Baylor University because he was participating in religious things. Not on campus, but in his personal life. They're basically purging it, you know, to get rid of all the religious aspects of what used to be a religious college. So, you know, it's just happening all over the place. Well, what's behind this trend, and why doesn't God intervene to set the record straight? It's two questions. What's behind the trend, and why doesn't God intervene to set the record straight? Well, I think there are at least three things behind this trend. Number one would be, not in no particular order, but the failure of religion. failure of religion. 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 5. I'm going to read this in the New Living Translation. Very familiar territory. That's one reason I decided to read in a different translation. You might pick up something new from reading it from a different translation. But Paul, writing to Timothy, says, "You should also know this, Timothy, that in the last days there will be very difficult times. For people will love only themselves and their money." Of course, that doesn't describe today, does it? "They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God." Remember that word. We're going to see that again a little later. "Disobedient to their parents and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred." Well, that's true, isn't it? "They will be unloving," verse 3, "and unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and have no interest in what is good." In fact, you're not supposed to use the word good. You know, that's judgmental, right? You say values, but don't say good or evil, because that's, you can't say it's bad to do it. That would be bad to say it's bad to do. Well, anyway, you know what I mean. "They will act as if they are religious, but they will reject the power that could make them godly. You must stay away from people like that." Now, you know, there's some legitimacy for people to question religious teachings if they assume that Christianity today, not the magazine, but the state of Christianity, represents the Bible. I mean, I made the same mistake myself before God woke me up and brought me to my senses. I assumed that the church I was attending was representing God in the Bible. And I saw through the hypocrisy, and I thought, this is supposed to prove God in the Bible. Forget it. So I became an agnostic. So in a sense, you can't blame people, but that's one of the factors that's behind this, is failure of religion. A second point, which is even more fundamental, is that man of himself is unable to properly process spiritual truths. Man of himself is unable to properly process spiritual truths. I think we tend to forget that. After you've been in the church for a while, we can pick up the Bible and read it and understand it and just wonder, well, why can't other people understand this? Well, the Bible tells us why. Again, I'll use New Living Translation, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, starting in verse 18. We'll read first of all through verse 25. 1 Corinthians 1, beginning in verse 18. Paul is writing here to the church at Corinth, saying, "I know very well how foolish the message of the cross sounds to those who are on the road to destruction. But we who are being saved recognize this message as the very power of God. As the scriptures say, I will destroy human wisdom and discard their most brilliant ideas." Now, that's the good news about all this nonsense that you see nowadays, is that God will eventually destroy it. So where does this leave the philosophers, the scholars, and this world's brilliant debaters? Verse 20. "God has made them all look foolish and has shown their wisdom to be useless nonsense." That's very good words. I mean, to us, you know, who understand, it is foolish nonsense. I mean, it's laughable. It really is. You might throw in the latest Ten Commandments movie along with the bunch there, too, because that's definitely a different than it really happened. Verse 21, "Since God in his wisdom saw to it that the world would never find him through human wisdom, he has used our foolish preaching to save all those who believe. God's way seems foolish to the Jews because they want a sign from heaven to prove it's true. And it is foolish to the Greeks because they believe only what agrees with their own wisdom." That's the scientific method. That's what we do in the United States today. Hey, you can't prove this by science, they say. I mean, never mind it, that, you know, common sense. I mean, if you can't measure it, if you don't have evidence, if you don't have, you know, things that go through the scientific process, they consider it nonsense and reject it. Verse 24, "But to those called by God to salvation, both Jews and Gentiles, Christ is the mighty power of God and the wonderful wisdom of God. This foolish," quote-unquote, "plan of God is far wiser than the wisest of human plans, and God's weakness is far stronger than the greatest of human strength." Going on in chapter 2, verse 6, Paul says, "By contrast, when I'm among mature Christians, I do speak with words of wisdom, but not the kind of wisdom that belongs to this world, and not the kind that appeals to the rulers of this world who are being brought to nothing," which is certainly true, isn't it? "No, the wisdom we speak of is the secret wisdom of God, which was hidden in former times, though he made it known for our benefit before the world began." Verse 8, "But the rulers of this world have not understood it. If they had, they would never have crucified our glorious Lord." That is what the scriptures mean when they say, quote, "No eye has seen, no ear has heard, and no mind has imagined what God has prepared for those who love him." End of the quote. Verse 10, but we know these things because God has revealed them to us by His Spirit. And His Spirit searches out everything and shows us even God's deep secrets. No one can know what anyone else is really thinking except that person alone. That's kind of a different take on the spirit of man, but anyway, that's both are true. And God has actually given us His Spirit, not the world's spirit, so that we can know the wonderful things that God has freely given us. When we tell you this, we don't use words of human wisdom. We speak words given to us by the Spirit, using the Spirit's words to explain spiritual truths. Verse 14, but people who aren't Christians can't understand these truths from God's Spirit. Very important point. People who aren't Christians, and that's a liberal translation, that's in essence what it means. People who aren't Christians can't understand these truths from God's Spirit. It all sounds foolish to them because only those who have the Spirit can understand what the Spirit means. And there you have it, right in a nutshell. It is impossible. They're on a different wavelength. You know, I mean, we don't have halos over our heads. Their eyes aren't crossed. They don't drool. You know, I mean, you don't look any different than anybody else, but the thought is totally different. You know, you read the New Testament and you see the things that Jesus said, and you see the general public, most of them didn't get it. They were on a totally different wavelength. And sometimes we tend to forget that. We who have the Spirit understand these things, but others can't understand us at all. How could they? Who can know what the Lord is thinking? Who can give Him counsel? But we can understand these things, for we have the mind of Christ. So there it is. I mean, it tells us that it's really not possible for people to process that spiritual light. As simple a thing is to say, well, God did this. God, a personal being, did this. You know, there are a lot of people that claim to believe in God, but what kind of a God do they believe in? They believe in a personal being that works miracles? Or do they believe in a higher power or an impersonal force or whatever? You know, or the principle of good? There are beliefs all over the map. A simple statement in Psalm 10 and verse 4 that really kind of puts this down into one sentence, summarizes everything Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. It says, the wicked in his proud countenance does not seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. God is in none of his thoughts. There's a reason for that we'll get to later. But New International Version of this says, in his pride, the wicked does not seek him. In all his thoughts, there is no room for God. It's a conflict of interest, I guess you'd call it, wouldn't you? New Living says, these wicked people are too proud to seek God. They seem to think that God is dead. Well, see, you got two things that are being said here. Number one is that there is a different dimension of thinking, the spiritual realm. As simple as it is us to read this as God did something, God opened the waters of the Red Sea, that's simple for us to understand. But for a person who doesn't believe in a personal God, they just believe in a force of goodness or something like that, they think, well, a force of goodness can't open the Red Sea, so how did it happen? Well, turn to the scientists and they'll explain it, say, give you the answer. And the second reason is pride. Does everybody have pride? Yeah. Some people have more than others, of course. Pride gets in the way. Remember the Bible says that, talks about God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble? You suppose there are very many leaders in industry, in government, in education, that have a little too much pride? Yeah, I think so. So the third reason is then human nature is hostile to God. And we know that very well from Romans 8 and verse 7, don't we? Which says the carnal mind is enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. It's an absolute impossibility. It's a total conflict of interest. There's no way that carnal mind can be subject to the law of God. The New Living Translation of that passage says, for the sinful nature is always hostile to God. It never did obey God's laws, and it never will. So human nature is on a totally opposite course to the law of God, just like pride is on a totally opposite course from humility. New Revised Standard says, for this reason, the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God. It does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. It's an utter impossibility. That's why it says in Isaiah 59, you know, that sin separates people from God. There is no commonality. There's no common ground. So you got the combination of three things here that are causing this recent trend. failure of religion. Madhav himself is unable to process spiritual truths. And third aspect being human nature, pride, hostility, and what have you. Well, what does this have to do with this recent scientific trend? I mean, what's the point here? Romans 1 and verse 18, I read this in the New King James, first of all. Romans 1 and verse 18 says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." That's a very strong statement, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Most of the translations say that their unrighteous conduct suppresses the truth. And that may well be true, but it also is true that there was a time in history where individuals knew God and suppressed the truth because of unrighteousness. That's what it goes on to say in the next verse, and I'm going to pick it up here with the New International Version. Verse 19 says, "Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." As one speaker I heard recently said, look out the window. It's all you have to do. Look at anything. I mean, you can do this as a family project sometime. Just pick up anything and say, how does this prove God exists? Everything does. Everywhere you look. So it says they're without excuse. Now here's an interesting statement in verse 21. "For although they knew God," they knew it. They were without excuse. They had the information there, but what did they do? In unrighteousness, they suppressed the truth. They said, well, we're going to chunk this. And there's a reason for it that has to do with those three points we mentioned earlier. "So although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools," which is what you do when you reject the knowledge of God. You become fools. And someday that will be shown to be that way. "And exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles." I've made this statement before in reference to that important point which says they knew God, but they suppressed the truth. And that is, until the end of the 16th century, there wasn't such, believe it or not, there wasn't such a thing as an atheist that denied the existence of God, at least in terms of the movers and shakers of thought. There's a book I have at home that is a really quite a fascinating book. Some of you may be familiar with History of God by Karen Armstrong. I found this book when... several years back when we were challenged by the subject of the Trinity, because it has a lot of good information here about that. And it basically is just what the title says, the history of God. It's how mankind has progressed, or perhaps you should say retrogressed, over a period of time. Let me share a quote with you from this book. "Indeed, by the end of the 16th century, many people in Europe felt that religion had been gravely discredited. They were disgusted by the killing of Catholics by Protestants and Protestants by Catholics." So here we got a first point I mentioned. Failure of religion started way back there. "Hundreds of people had died as martyrs for holding views that it was impossible to prove one way or the other. Sects preaching a bewildering variety of doctrines that were deemed essential for salvation had proliferated alarmingly." Sounds like today, doesn't it? A lot of these things, end of the 16th century. "There was now too much theological choice. Many felt paralyzed and distressed by the variety of religious interpretations on offer. Some may have felt that faith was becoming harder to achieve than ever. It was therefore significant at this point in the history of the Western God, people started spotting, quote-unquote, atheists, who seemed to be as numerous as the witches, the old enemies of God and allies of the devil. It was said that these atheists, quote-unquote, had denied the existence of God, were acquiring converts to their sect, and undermining the fabric of society." So what they called an atheist was somebody that, well, if you believe that, if that's what you believe, you don't even believe in God, you're an atheist. It wasn't saying that people really didn't believe in God. It was an insult. It was an epithet against people whose doctrines were so different. The other people of probably the mainstream accused these other people of being atheists. That's where the term apparently started. Now, going on. "Yet, in fact, a full-blown atheism, in the sense that we use the word today, was impossible. As Lucien Febvre has shown in his classic book, The Problem of Unbelief in the 16th Century, the conceptual difficulties in the way of a complete denial of God's existence at this time were so great as to be insurmountable. From birth and baptism to death and burial in the churchyard, religion dominated the life of every single man and woman. That isn't true today. But this was, it was total religious society in the Western world. Every activity of the day, which was punctuated with church bells, summoning the thankful faithful to prayer, was saturated with religious beliefs and institutions. They dominated professional and public life. Even the guilds and the universities were religious organizations. I just mentioned Baylor. It started out as a religious college. A lot of those colleges were funded by churches. And since that time, they're being purged of any aspect of Christianity. You know, professors being fired, and this whole article, like I said, in World Magazine on the subject. So that, you know, that's a more recent development. How tiny is the area of our lives that is already secularized compared to everything that is still governed, regulated, and shaped by religion? That was at that time. Even if an exceptional man could have achieved the objectivity necessary to question the nature of religion and the existence of God, he would have found no support in either the philosophy or science of his time. My, how things have changed. Isn't that amazing? End of the 16th century, this is. Until there had formed a body of coherent reasons, each of which was based upon another cluster of scientific verifications, nobody could deny the existence of a God whose religion shaped and dominated the moral, emotional, aesthetic, and political life of Europe. Without this support, such a denial could only be a personal whim or a passing impulse that was unworthy of serious consideration. You know, kind of the way we look at this stuff that we read, you know, or see on TV. As this author has shown, a vernacular language such as French lacked either the vocabulary or the syntax for skepticism. Such words as absolute, relative, causality, concept, and intuition were not yet in use. They didn't have a word for it. You know, it wasn't possible at that time, even at that late date. We should also remember that as yet no society in the world had eliminated religion, which was taken for granted as a fact of life. Not until the very end of the 18th century would a few Europeans find it possible to deny the existence of God. Now, I'm not a historian, but isn't that incredible? And this is a lady actually who used to be a Catholic nun, by the way. Well, you know what? There was a prophecy that tells us that. 2 Peter chapter 3 and first six verses. In other words, this was a trend. It's a very late trend. I mean, we just assume, I mean, naively sometimes we don't think it through, that the world's always been this way. The fact is, it hasn't. It simply hasn't. There wasn't any possibility of that in times past in the Western world. Verse 1 of 2 Peter 3, Beloved, I now write to you this second epistle, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of a reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets, and the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior. Verse 3, Knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts, and saying, Where is the promise of his coming? The word scoffer means someone who doesn't believe something and who ridicules, makes fun of it, okay? Where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. It's a naturalistic explanation, you know? I mean, there's no proof, there's no evidence, there's no promise. For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. What are we talking about here? We're talking about the universal flood. I'm sure that National Geographic has had programs explaining away the flood as being a local occurrence. You know, I mean, I've never seen it. I don't particularly want to, unless it's hard to find good comedies these days. That's the closest thing you can find, you know. Let me read you a quotation from Barclay's Daily Study Bible that explains this rhetorical question, where is the promise of his coming? It says, literally, their question was, where is the promise of his coming? That was a form of Hebrew expression which implied that the thing asked about did not exist at all. See that? They're saying, ain't going to happen. So where they're saying it, where's the promise he's coming? Where is the God of justice? Asked the evil men of Malachi's day. Malachi 2, verse 17. Where is your God? The heathen demanded of the psalmist. Psalm 42, verse 3. Psalm 79, verse 10. Where is the word of the Lord? His enemies asked Jeremiah 17, verse 15. In every case, the implication of the question is that the thing or the person asked about does not exist. Very interesting. The heretics, he says, were denying that Jesus Christ would ever come again. I don't have the latest information, but it's astounding how many even, quote-unquote, born-again Christians don't believe Christ is going to return, let alone atheists, agnostics, scientific people, and what have you. Well, there's your prophecy. Said at the end time that you would have scoffers denying the very existence of God, denying the return of Jesus Christ, denying so many of the biblical truths that we hold so dear. Back to Romans chapter 1 again. Romans 1 and verse 22. I'm reading this in the New International, but it's pretty similar in the New King James. Professing to be wise, they became fools. You know, for anybody to seriously suggest that the way Jesus walked on water was to walk on chunks of ice, to be able to walk up in front of TV cameras with a leaf blower, constructing a rock bridge and blowing on that, blowing the water out there, to suggest that a volcanic bridge under the water was how the Israelites escaped from Egypt, and it was just at the exact right time, and it collapsed just at the right time in the Egyptians. I mean, is that foolish or what? I feel sorry for those people when they have their opportunity to understand. It's going to be a very embarrassing situation, but it's going to be good for them, you know, because people that have pride have to be humbled. Psalm 14, actually, as is stated in two different places, puts it very strongly. And if/when I write this article, I will quote this and remind the readership, these aren't my words, they're the Bible's words. Psalm 14, verse 1 says, only fools say in their hearts there's no God. You know, there it is. Only fools say in their hearts there's no God. They are corrupt and their actions are evil. No one does good. This is also repeated in Psalm 53 and verse 1. I read this in the New Living Translation, by the way. That last part, it says that no one seeks good. That's quoted in Romans chapter 3, where it says all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Back to Romans 1 again. Romans chapter 1, continuing on in verse 23. Verse 22 said, professing to be wise, they became fools. And verse 23 says, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Now, why would somebody do a stupid thing like that? Well, because you got control over those, see? Right? We sometimes are called in the past a hip-pocket God. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts. Now we're talking about the consequences of this type of thing, of throwing God out the window, throwing the Bible out the window. This reads like a commentary of much of our culture today. So God also gave them up for this reason to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burn in their lust for one another, men committing with men what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. Another key statement, verse 28. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. Now, that's not every man, woman, and child in this nation. Please, don't think that way. Don't paint everybody the same broad brush. But to the extent that people reject God and His Word and His truth, this is a natural consequence. And more, the trend of our culture, our society, is going that direction. That one belief is just as good as another. You know, and the discredit is continuing, and especially in the scientific community, among a lot of the leaders of thought. Question, why doesn't God intervene to set the record straight? It'd be so easy. All He'd have to do is just appear anywhere, work a miracle that nobody could deny, and these people would be reduced to nothing. Why doesn't He do that? Well, let me give you a very interesting point here, first of all, in Luke 16, the parable of Lazarus and a rich man. Now, I forget what translation this is here. I think it might be the New King James. But anyway, you're familiar with the parable probably. This rich man, you know, was facing the lake of fire, and it was in mental anguish and agony. And he thought of his family, not being aware, you know, the passage of time, because after a person dies, they're not aware of any passage of time. And he cries out. He realized, I've had it. It's obvious. The fires are coming, and I'm sunk. But what about the rest of my family? Verse 24, he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus, he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I'm tormented in this flame, or by this flame. Abraham said, verse 25, son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, and likewise Lazarus' evil things. The table's a turn, basically. He says, now he's comforted, and you are tormented. And besides all this, between us and you, there's a great gulf fixed, so that those who want to pass from here to you cannot, nor can those from there pass to us. Notice what he says in verse 27. Then he said, I beg you, therefore, Father, that you would send him, that is Abraham, to my father's house. Or from the dead, in other words. You know, send him back from the dead. Abraham said to him, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. He said, oh, no, Father Abraham, but if one goes to them from the dead, they will repent. Look at the answer. But he said, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded though one rise from the dead. Isn't that an incredible statement? See, the problem is not that people don't know. The problem is that they don't really want to know. So therefore, if someone were raised from the dead, they would find some way to get out of it. I know that seems incredible, but that's what it says. Because, to put it another way, the problem is not logical, it's theological. The solution will not simply happen by education. It has to be a change of human nature. So, yeah, God could do that. God could say, okay, I'm going to appear, you know, in this big conference of theologians that are saying it's okay for people of the same sex to marry. I'm going to appear at this scientific convention that's coming up all this nonsense, the historical record, and debunking what the Bible says. But it wouldn't change him. I have talked about, for a long time, use this example, the movie that some of you have seen already. Title of the movie is Oh God. It's a rather tongue-in-cheek, some people would probably consider sacrilegious, so that's the way movies are. You know, one person meets another person's poison. So I'm not going to recommend that you watch the movie if you see this as being sacrilegious. Because God is played by George Burns. Okay? And that's not exactly a good concept of God. But some of the lessons in that movie, I'm not going to show you the whole movie, I'll show you a clip, but some of the lessons in that movie illustrate the things we've been talking about in the sermon. The gist of the plot, and if you want to watch it, it's still not going to ruin it because it's still a pretty interesting thing to watch if you're able to overlook the tongue-in-cheek humor, which some could consider sacrilegious. Like God admits he made some mistakes, like he made the pit of the avocado too big. Things like that, you know. That was some of the humor in there. But anyway, the plot was that there was a grocery clerk. In fact, I think he was the head of the produce section. It was played by John Denver. Young guy, you know, low income, driving this old car and stuff. was chosen by God, played by George Burns, to proclaim his message to the world. To tell people, you know, I really want you to be happy. I've given you everything you need to be happy. And I love you and I want you to be happy. And that was his assignment, you know, to do this. And as you go through the movie, he would go, and he was trying to get an audience, and of course people dismissed him as a crackpot. He went everywhere. He went to newspapers, he went to religious leaders, and they said, you know, where's your evidence? And he would say, why doesn't God do something? Why doesn't God come in here and back me up? Instead, he was made to look foolish. You know, they had newscasts on TV. He got on Dinah Shore's show, you know, and they made fun of him there. And they asked him, what does God look like, you know, and had this artist there from the police force that does the character sketches of criminals, you know. And he drew the picture, and they showed it, and it was George Burns. And, you know, all sorts of things. He's ridiculed all the way down the line. Well, finally, a bunch of theologians got together, and they said, okay, we're going to give you a test. If you really have talked to God, you'll know the answers to these questions. Okay? So he got the questions, and God appears again. He says, let me see it. He says, oh, this is tricky. This is written in what language? I forget it was. Anyway, an ancient language, which he wouldn't have been able to understand. Well, so God takes this and dictates the answers. See? And the young man writes them all down and everything. And he says, okay, now take these back to this bullhard religious evangelist here. And he says, I want you to give him a message for me. Tell him I don't like what he's doing. And tell him to go get a job selling something if he wants to make money. So, you know, this guy's having this big evangelistic campaign and all these people in there, and they have the guard standing up front, you know, to protect him. And he takes up this big offering, give me and you're giving to the Lord, you know, that type of thing. And so in walks this young man, and this guy recognized him because he had a confrontation with him before, you remember. So he comes up and says, oh, this is the man that claims he's seen God. And it was boo, hiss, you know. So he says, well, God said that he had a message for it. Oh, he did. He says, yeah, and then he gave him the message. And everybody heard it. Well, of course, that didn't go over so well. So this evangelist sues him, takes him to court to sue him for slander and breach of character and that type of thing. And he has his attorney in there, you know, and saying, so when did you see God last, and what did he look like? He said, well, he appears as a busboy. Everybody laughs. So you mean the all-omnipotent, great, wonderful God appears as a busboy? Yes, I rest my case, the attorney says. Now it comes the young man's time. He represented himself. He didn't hire an attorney. He represented himself. In the audience where the evangelist, his attorney, theological leaders of different organizations, big name thing. At this point, we'll play the clip, and I'm going to ask you to help me to finish the sermon when you see this. Picture's worth a thousand words. Okay, I want you to see this, and bear in mind some of the things we've talked about so far in the sermon, and see if it doesn't make a lot of sense to you.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to call one witness and one witness only.
Well, I'm waiting, Mr. Landers.
Yes. Your Honor, I would like to call to the stand the Lord God.
I object. Defendant's trying to make a mockery of this proceeding.
Your Honor, I was trying to make a point.
What point?
Your Honor, when I just asked God to take the stand, in that fleeting moment after I called him, wasn't there a trace of expectation in your mind? Just a trace, Your Honor? I mean, wasn't there a hesitation in this room? Didn't you feel it? Didn't we all feel it? It was a possibility that God does exist. And if he exists, he could materialize and sit right in that chair. And in that moment, Your Honor, when no one in this room knew what was going to happen next, in that flash of an instant lies the benefit of the doubt that you must give me to know that my story is true and that I spoke exactly as God asked me.
Mr. Landers, I cautioned you earlier that proper legal representation would be helpful. I must now warn you that, in addition to the plaintiff's charges, I'm seriously considering citing you with contempt for what you apparently thought was a very clever stunt. Now, you're getting deeper and deeper into trouble with this court, Mr. Landers.
Excuse me, Your Honor. It's him. Bobby, it's him.
This is most irregular.
Your Honor, he...
I'll take it from here.
May I ask who you are, sir?
You better swear me in. You'll never believe it.
You swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
So help me, me.
So help you, you?
If it pleases the court, and even if it doesn't please the court, I'm God, Your Honor.
Welcome to the court.
Your Honor, I'd like permission to question this witness.
Sit down, Sonny. I've answered enough questions. Saw me. Just like he said. Each word true. The man tried to tell a lie, his tongue would snap off. Which I wouldn't say I could say about everybody. Why is it so hard for you to believe? Is my physical existence any more improbable than your own? What about all that hoo-ha with the devil a while ago from that movie? Nobody had any trouble believing that the devil took over and existed in the little girl. All she had to do was wet the rug, fill up some pea soup, and everybody believed. The devil you could believe, but not God, huh? I work in my own way. I don't get inside little children. They got enough to do just being themselves. Also, I'm not about to go around to every person in the world and say, look, it's me, I want to talk to you. So I picked one man. One very good man. I told him God lives. I live. He had trouble believing, too, in the beginning. I understood. I'm not sure how this whole miracle business started. The idea that anything connected with me has to be a miracle. Personally, I'm sorry that it did. Makes the distance between us even greater. But if the miracle helps you believe that I am who I say I am, I'll give you a good one. Let me see. What's my most impressive miracle? Uh-huh. Pick a card.
What?
Pick a card. Any card.
I don't know what you think you're doing.
A cute little miracle. Go ahead, pick one.
Well, there are no cards there.
Look again.
Nothing miraculous about good sleight of hand.
Have you ever seen this one?
Well, yes, I've seen them make cards appear and disappear. As a matter of fact, I once saw a magician make an elephant disappear.
Good. Now I'll show you one that you haven't seen. Gotta get these shoes fixed. Watch this, Your Honor. I know how hard it is in these times to have faith. But maybe if you could have the faith to start with, maybe the times would change. If it changed them, think about it. Try. And try not to hurt each other. There's been enough of that. It really gets in the way. I'm a god of very few words, and Jerry's already given you mine. However hopeless...
court is now recessed. May I see both parties in my chambers, please?
You swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth?
So help you, you?
Where's...
Order the court. Your Honor, I'd like permission to question.
All there is. Not one word of what I assume we all assume we heard.
Someone must have erased it.
Nobody erases tapes anymore.
Well, then the machine...
No, nothing wrong with it.
He said he couldn't be recorded. God, when he first spoke to me, he said it wasn't his real voice I heard. He said he was just using one that I could understand. He did it again today.
And there's nothing wrong with your stenotype machine?
It took down every word, Your Honor, except now some of them are not on the paper.
Don't you see? He wants us all to decide for ourselves whether or not we saw him and heard him. It's what he always said. Everything is up to us.
No, no. There is no proof whatsoever that God was in that courtroom today.
Oh, none whatsoever.
We saw him. We heard him.
We did.
He made himself, and the cards disappear.
I saw it.
On the basis of our common experience here today, I can see why you first claimed and later maintained that you had seen and been in the actual presence of God. And for that reason, your remarks to the... Reverend Williams could be regarded as a divine assignment. I shall rule, therefore, that the charge of slander be dismissed.
So you.
Now, if, as you also claim, it is God's opinion that we should all make our own decisions and abide by them accordingly, then I must also rule that on the basis of the evidence... Or rather, the lack of it, that as much as we all may think that what we saw here today was real, that God did not, in fact, appear here before us. May, of course, appeal to a higher court.
We heard from the highest court. Bye, Mr. Slavitt.
Oh, Jerry. We'll send you your picture.
Oh. Okay. Would you do that?
No.
It goes on from there. Lucy's job. And so pardon the, you know, the irreverences there and the comedy and everything, but what was the lessons? What were the lessons?
They didn't learn any.
They didn't learn any. What did they do?
Tonight.
Remember the old saying, don't confuse any of the facts, my mind's made up? Now, of course, that's totally fictitious, but it's totally true to human nature. I mean, it couldn't have been God. And he erased the evidence. Okay, now we can go back to square one. You see how that evangelist was sweating it out there for a while? Until he removed the evidence? I think that answers the question. So why doesn't God intervene to set the record straight? And how and when will he enter? Because he's going to. We know that.
The movie portrayed a lowly grocery. I don't, no insult, Susie's husband here. Portrayed, I mean, let's face it, he's not, that position is not considered the highest in thought leaders. Portrayed a lowly grocery store employee as someone God chose to proclaim his message to the world. Does that sound kind of familiar? 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 through 29. Read this in a New Revised Version. Standard Version. Consider your own call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. It's exactly what we saw portrayed there, same type of situation. 2 Peter 3, verses 7 through 9. New King James Version. Remember we read about before how the people willingly rejected the truth of the flood? Goes on and talks a little bit more about that. But the heavens and the earth which are now preserved by the same word are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. In other words, it's saying God's not going to do a flood of water anymore. But that is actually a type of the destruction of all the elements in a lake of fire. So if people can dismiss the flood, then they don't have to believe, say, that there's coming a time where the earth will be destroyed by fire. But beloved, don't forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise. You know, in the movie, John Denver portrayed the young man as saying, you know, why is, in fact, it was right before I, maybe I could have started a little earlier, saying to his wife, I don't understand why God's leaving me hanging here. You ever feel that way? You ever feel like John Denver portrayed in a movie, you're trying to explain something to somebody and they look at you like you're nuts? Yeah, why doesn't God step in and bail me out here? Good question. Well, here's the answer. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. See, because if he did it too soon, you'd have a situation like this. Right? It wouldn't have done any good. It just would have put these people on the spot, and God would have to say, you know, I appeared, they rejected me knowingly, they're sunk. This is a whole doctrine that we understand. It's so, such an encouraging doctrine that God is not trying to save everybody today. So he simply stays out of the picture and lets people come up with all this stupid stuff until man is ready to destroy himself, and then God will walk in. Not in the person of George Burns, obviously, but still illustrates the point. God's timing is always perfect. There's that line before. But people still have to have the time to learn the lessons they need to suffer from it, so that they'll actually finally come to repentance. God's not going to intervene until such a time. If he did it prematurely, situation would take place very similar to what you saw portrayed there. People would make excuses and reject him knowingly, and he'd have to condemn them. So he's not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. How far away is that time? Well, you know, Matthew 24, verse 32 says, learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it's near, right at the door. You know, one of the things we said, we read from the Bible, it said that in the last days, there'd be scoffers, okay, denying the truths of God. We see this proliferating now more than ever before. It didn't start until, there wasn't such a thing as an atheist until about the 18th century. And now, at this point in time, you've got stuff coming out of the woodwork, discrediting and disclaiming the promises of God. I would say that that is leaves on the fig tree. This time of year, you look out, things are starting to turn green. You know, summer's coming. Look at the newspapers. All these articles coming out. Look at the TV. All these things are around, but this time is coming close. I tell you the truth, this generation certainly will not pass away, so all these things have happened. Earth, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. But that, at some point, is going to have to be proclaimed to the world. That things, and it has been. Okay, and people laugh at it. Yeah, the world's coming out. Ha ha, tell me another one. That's the reaction right now. But I want you to notice what it says in verse 37. Comparing the time of the end to what? As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day that Noah entered the ark, and knew nothing about what was about to happen. I'm reading the International here. Until the flood came and took them all away. That's how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. New Living says people didn't realize what was going to happen until the flood came and swept them all away. Think about this. I'm not predicting anything. I'm just saying, wouldn't it be interesting if Noah's Ark were discovered shortly before this all happens? A lot of people claim that they have found it in the mountains in Turkey. Evidence hasn't come forth yet. It hasn't been proven beyond the shadow of a doubt. You know, there's no evidence, so, at least according to one of these so-called experts in National Geographic, no evidence of an exodus. No written records, no archaeological proof. And so people can say, well, this didn't happen. That's all. One step further than saying, well, you know, if the Bible record is true, well, it may have said that, but it happened by natural means. And the next step is to say, well, it didn't happen at all because we've got no proof, we've got no evidence. Wouldn't it be interesting if the ark were discovered, where it could not be denied, this is Noah's ark? What an incredible show and tell that would be able to preach the gospel and say, you know what? You didn't believe that, did you? Scientific community had all these pseudo-explanations for this worldwide flood, claiming it didn't happen. Here's the evidence right here. Now, you know what? God said that he's never going to flood the earth with water again, but he's going to destroy the earth with fire. Wouldn't that be a powerful way? I don't know. I mean, that may not happen. But that's the reason God has not intervened before now. But that may change in the future. And it might be something else. There might be some other thing that's discovered that would just blow the scientific community away. If it's done prematurely, you get the same result as these people. Of course, there you're talking about tape recording. I mean, are you going to be able to keep the press from something like that? Is that really going to be able to be hidden, something like that comes up? No, it won't. So I personally wonder if, when the time is right, right before the end, when God really wants to reach the world in a way that can't be denied, that maybe there might be some sort of special discovery that might be made that will force people to realize, you know, the Bible is actually true, what it says, and people will be without excuse. Well, this may or may not happen, but we can expect the recent trend to continue right up to the end, just as in the days of Noah. The senseless wranglings of these so-called experts may provide the material for comic books in the world tomorrow, I believe. But in the meantime, we need to be prepared to deal with the barrage of negative press about God and the Bible. It should help us understand what's behind it, I believe, why God allows it, and how he'll set the record straight. Because you probably may be wondering, why doesn't God intervene to really show these people what's what? Well, I think when you put all these things together, you realize why God has chosen not to do that. Left hands off so people would have to learn the hard way from their lessons. And then when they're ready to listen, God will say, okay, here I am. Or maybe right at the end of the age, right before he has to intervene to save mankind, he'll choose to reveal himself through some discovery like this or something similar. Like the man portrayed in the movie by John Denver, we need to be ready and willing to accept the role that God has given us to proclaim his message to the world, both now and also after Christ returns. Because right now, we're pretty much spitting into the wind. These people don't listen. They don't even show up to listen. You know, it can really be discouraging sometimes. You think about how important this knowledge is. And you advertise it and you tell people about it. I made that point when the Bible said, look around how many people are here. You know, not that we have all the truth, but just, you know, something as important as this. If anybody claims to have knowledge of something that important, you would think more people would say, well, boy, it's like I did with that treasure. This may be just a hoax, but, you know, I can't afford not to check this out. But that's not the way people are right now. We know that's all going to change after Christ returns. And he's training us right now to be able to give God's message to mankind at a time when they'll really be ready to listen and believe and respond. That time isn't here yet, so in the meantime, enjoy the articles that come out and get your laughs, because time is coming and all that's going to be changed.